shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
You have known of the fact, of course, the satanic origin of the Jewish people, but I don't know whether many of you have seen how much proof there is in the Bible, and I thought it was just about time to get down to that proof. Now let's start in the beginning. Satan, of course, was not a serpent. The thing that deceived Eve and seduced Eve was not a scaly thing wiggling along the ground. The Hebrew word nokash means enchanter or magician. Now, a fallen angel, retaining still a lot of his angelic powers, no doubt could be very much of an enchanter or magician. Now, his children, and I mean children, not just followers, through the centuries, used a serpent as a symbol or emblem of their ancestor, until finally they attached a secondary meaning of serpent to the word, but it is not in the root meaning of the word at all. And the Bible was never so ridiculous as to suggest that a snake accomplished all of this. Now, in Genesis 3, verses 2 and 3, you remember Satan has said to Eve, why is it really true that God said you can't eat of any tree in the garden? And she replies to him, here's how it reads in the Hebrew, and the woman said unto the enchanter, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But of, now I'm quoting from King James Version, and I'm going to correct it then as I go. But of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. Now let's see what it actually says in the Hebrew. Fruit, that's the Hebrew word pirkoch, meaning progeny, brood, children, descendants. Do you talk about the children of a walnut tree or an apple tree? Of course you don't. Now, of the pirkoch, of the descendants of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it. And that touch is the Hebrew word naga, which is a more polite expression meaning to have sexual intercourse with. Do you need to be warned not to have sexual intercourse with an apple? Of course not. It isn't that kind of a tree. Now, God had millions of the pre-Adamic Asiatic and African peoples around. If he just wanted somebody wide between the shoulders and narrow between the eyes to spade up the garden, he had them. He didn't have to create a special being for that. Satan had been the governor of this planet until he forfeited the right to it by rebellion. God sent Adam here, and you remember that the last verse in the third chapter of the Gospel of Luke tells you that Adam was the son of God. It doesn't say that about any of these pre-Adamic peoples mentioned in Genesis chapter 1. Adam was the son of God, and he sent Adam here to take over by force, kick Satan out, and govern this planet. And the trees in the Garden of Eden were the family trees of nations and races. They were supposed not to intermingle with these people. If these Negroes and Mongoloids were all that God wanted, he already had them. What he created a different and separate being for was to have a different sort of person whom the Mongoloids and the Negroids never could produce. The Hebrew word Adam, which we translate Adam, means of a rosy, fair complexion. Adam was the first person of a specifically created new race. Well, Adam and Eve were told, don't you mongrelize your race now with these pre-Adamite peoples in the world. Now, when you come to Genesis 3, verse 15, God has called Adam, Eve, and Satan before him to give an accounting of their misdeeds. And according to your King James Version, Eve says the Satan beguiled, the enchanter, well, she says serpent. The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat thereof. Well, now, again, it's that Hebrew word nokash, meaning enchanter. But instead of beguiled, the Hebrew word noshaw means seduced. Now, beguiled is no more than deceived. Somebody who sells you some mining stock in the mine that doesn't have any good ore in it beguiles you. But this word means seduced. And Yahweh God said unto the woman, what is this thou hast done? And the woman said, the enchanter seduced me. That's what it says in the Hebrew. And Cain was the product thereof. So in reply, in Genesis 3:15, God says this. He's speaking to Satan. I will put enmity between thee, Satan, and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. Now, the same Hebrew word zera, literally meaning seed, and it could be used of grains of wheat, for example, but it's used throughout the Bible as meaning the descendants of a person, too, children, posterity. Thy seed, zera, and her seed, zera. In other words, Satan was to have just as literal children in this world as was Eve, because the very same word with the very same meaning is used for it. Now our minister back in Minnesota says, oh, that doesn't mean anything, because he quotes Genesis 4, verse 1. And Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain. Now, you notice what is not said is more significant here than what is said. The Bible nowhere says that Adam begot Cain. Remember now, as you've read the Old Testament, the monotonous regularity with which it always says, and so begat who's this, and who's this begat what's his name, and what's his name begat somebody else, and so on. It was important to know your ancestry in those days, because you didn't get your citizenship for two box tops and a dime. Got it because your ancestors for 20 generations back were Israelites, and no other way. Now, Adam knew his wife, and she conceived. Now, I can tell you something, and I can prove every bit of it by witnesses. I went to a movie one night, and the next morning the sun rose in the east. Now, I did not say the one caused the other. I said two things happened, one of them first and the other second. And they did, but I never said there was cause and effect. And the Bible never says there was cause and effect here. Now, if you want further proof out of this, you go right on to the fifth chapter of Genesis, which gives the list of Adam's descendants. And you notice that Cain is not mentioned. Neither Cain nor Abel are mentioned among descendants of Adam. And if you say, well, Abel might have been omitted because we don't know. He probably was killed before he left any descendants of his own. That's not true of Cain, because the Bible traces Cain's descendants for six generations, naming them on down the line. But never once does it say that Cain was a descendant of Adam. Never in any way, shape, form, or manner. The first time it says Adam begot a child is Genesis 5, verse 3. And Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own likeness and after his image, and called his name Seth, not Cain. So the satanic bloodline crept in definitely with Cain. Possibly earlier among the pre-Adamic peoples. Now, there were pre-Adamic peoples who were not necessarily satanic. There were some pre-Adamic people into whom the satanic bloodline came, and there were even some of the descendants of Adam who probably mongrelized. Well, in fact, it's evident that they did from the very fact that those living around Noah were wiped out by the flood, because the Bible tells you that Noah was perfect in his ancestry. No mongrelization. And he was the only one left who was. And that's why the mongrelized Adamites around him were wiped out by the flood. Well, the real descendants of Adam were multiplying. And then you come to the fact of the satanic bloodline getting in there. Now remember, God had announced his purpose that he was going to take back the world from satanic domination. He was going to rule it according to his purposes, and he was going to rule it through his children, going down through Adam. Now, what is the obvious move on Satan's part to thwart that? To mongrelize the two bloodlines so we can sneer in God's face. Well, these are my children now. Where are yours? All these have my bloodline in them. And that's exactly what he set out to do. Now, Genesis 6, verse 2, the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all they chose. Well, now you don't get the full significance of it in that translation. The sons of God, Beni HaElohim, the sons of the Elohim. Now you remember, the word, Hebrew word El, the mighty, is used as a title of God. Derived from it, Eloah, singular, is practically always translated God or a God, and a correct translation. And Elohim is the plural, meaning gods. You take in the 82nd Psalm, God standeth in the congregation of the gods. He says to them, I have said, ye are all Elohim and children of the Most High. Your King James Version just says, I says ye are gods, but it's a correct translation there of the Elohim. The sons of the Elohim saw the daughters of Adam, that they were fair. Now the Elohim are the children of God, and to that extent distinct from the angels, who are merely servant spirits. Now, we're not given too much detail on the rebellion that took place in heaven, but the Bible very definitely suggests that along with a number of the angels, some even of the Elohim, the sons of God, followed Satan into rebellion. Now, some people have tried to say, well, since the Adamites are spoken of as the sons of God, this is merely the Adamites here. But the sons of God saw the daughters of Adam, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all whom they chose. And it's written with obvious disapproval. Well, now, the male descendants of Adam were not allowed by God's law to marry anybody but the daughters of Adam. So if they were marrying within their own racial line here, it couldn't have been spoken of with disapproval. So the Beni HaElohim are evidently of those Elohim who followed Satan into rebellion. Now you go on into Genesis 6, verse 4, speaking of the same thing. And again, it's botched up in your King James Version. There were giants in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Well, now what it says in the Hebrew, there were the Nephilim, the fallen ones in the earth in those days. Sure, the fallen angels, that's what the Bible calls them so many places. The angels who had not kept their first estate, who had fallen from heaven and from their former powers. When the sons of God, and it's again the Beni HaElohim, came in under the daughters of Adam. So it's the same thing. So here you have the spreading of the satanic bloodline. And the Bible in Genesis chapter 6 goes on to trace many of these descendants of the fallen angels. You find that all through Palestine, on both sides of the Jordan River, clear down into Mount Seir, the rugged mountain range southeast of the Dead Sea, where Esau and his family lived, all through there, you had these various people with the satanic bloodline in them. Now, there are two different places, one in Isaiah, the other, as I remember it, in Ezekiel, where it speaks of what it calls a king or a prince, in the one case of Babylon and the other case of Tyre. But nevertheless, it speaks of him in language which couldn't possibly apply to anybody except Satan, indicating, therefore, that at some time or other, Satan had incarnated in the form of these various kings, one king of Babylon, one king of Tyre. Now, don't think that that's so impossible, because remember the many times that your Old Testament tells of these angels appearing in very solid form. They came and talked with Abraham on several occasions. One of them, you remember, wrestled with Jacob most all night. Another, when they were about to cross the Jordan and take over Palestine, Joshua, making a scouting trip around his camp, saw this armed man standing there in armor and with sword, and he said, "Are you for us or for the enemy?" And the man said, "I'm the captain of the hosts of Yahweh." So, let's take Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 21, and note now that this couldn't possibly apply to anyone except Satan himself. And I'm taking it out of the King James Version, too, for the benefit of my friend back in Minnesota. "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north." That is, I'm going to be ruler over Israel, God's people. "I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. They that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee and consider thee, saying, Is this the man that made the earth to tremble? That did shake kingdoms, that made the world as a wilderness and destroyed the cities thereof, that opened not the house of his prisoners? All the kings of the nations, even all of them, lie in glory, every one in his own house. But thou art cast out of thy grave like an abominable branch, and as the raiment of those that are slain, thrust through with a sword, that go down to the stones of the pit, as a carcass trodden under feet. Thou shalt not be joined with them in burial, because thou hast destroyed thy land and slain thy people. the seed of evildoers shall never be renowned. Now, you couldn't say that about any king of Babylon. The only one who may possibly have failed to get burial in an elaborate tomb and all that might have been Belshazzar, but he was nothing but an incompetent drunkard. And nobody ever could say of him that he was the one who shook kingdoms and so on. He didn't even rule Babylon. He just stayed drunk. Now, this is speaking throughout then of Lucifer. Now note how it goes on. I'm reading from the same passage, Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 21. Prepare slaughter for his children, for the iniquity of their fathers, that they do not rise nor possess the land, nor fill the face of the world with cities. And that word translated his children there is the Hebrew word beni, sons. So, Satan obviously was to have children who could be slaughtered to keep them from multiplying to the point where they would take over and rule the world. Old Testament, sure. Now let's see what the New Testament has to say about it. This gentleman back in Minnesota claims to be a Christian. So I want to call his attention to the words of Jesus Christ and see whether he's going to say Jesus Christ was a liar or mistaken, or whether he's willing to admit perhaps he was mistaken, because you can't reconcile the two. Jesus plainly and in a number of places says that the devil has children, not mere followers. You remember the parable of the tares and the wheat. He spoke of the farmer who sowed good seed in his field, and his enemy came along during the night time and sowed these poisonous weeds, the tares, among the wheat. And when the farmer's servants saw the tares growing among the wheat, they asked, well, shall we go out and pull them up now? And he said, no, you might pull up some of the wheat with them. Let them grow together until the time of the harvest, and then the reapers will first gather the tares into bundles to be burned, and then put the wheat in my barn. So now he goes on to explain this parable to his disciples. Matthew 13, verse 38. The field is the world. The good seed are the children of the kingdom. And he uses here the Greek word huioi, plural of huios, meaning sons. The good seed are the sons of the kingdom, but the tares are the children, huioi, of the wicked one. So Satan has just as true children in this world as does God. Again, speaking to the Pharisees, who, as you know, were Jews, Matthew 12, verse 34. Your King James Version botches it up to an extent that seems to me often to be willful. O generation of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. But the word is not generation at all. Generation is a number of people of not too different age living at the same time. You, for example, constitute one generation. He wasn't talking just about the people living then. They weren't any more wicked than the generation that lived before them or the generation that lived after them. What he said, it's the Greek word genema, which means children or offspring. O children of vipers. Sure, all these centuries you have used the serpent as the emblem or symbol for your ancestor, all right? Taking you at your own word, you children of serpents right down the line, vipers. He knew who they were. Again, Matthew 23, verses 29 through 35. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye build the tombs of the prophets, and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Therefore ye are witnesses unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. And here again, it's that Greek word, huioi. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers, ye serpents, ye genema, ye offspring, children of vipers. How can ye escape the damnation of hell, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, son of Berechias, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar? Now, does my friend back in Minnesota say that Jesus Christ was so unjust that he was going to punish these Jews for the murder of Abel if they weren't even descendants of Cain? Of course not. He was tracing here the children of the serpent, the enchanter, Satan, all down through the centuries, had murdered the righteous, including all the prophets, right down the line. So he said, upon you, upon this race, these descendants of the serpent, will come the responsibility for all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel, even unto the blood of Zacharias. So again, he was recognizing this. Now, throughout, the Bible speaks of two seed lines, and I do not mean merely somebody who has been converted to good views or bad. The Bible has no reference here at all to what your religious point of view may be. It is talking about literal descendants. In Romans 8, verse 16, the Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. Now, the word children there, the Greek word technon, meaning one born a child, not adopted. Nothing is more fallacious than this church doctrine about being adopted as the children of God. You read what Paul said on the subject, and nothing in it can justify the mistranslation of that as adoption. He says that before the coming of Christ, we were held in bondage under the law, governed strictly by the law. And he said, we are just like an heir under age. He has inherited from his father who has died all the estate, but he's still a minor, and he is not allowed to take control of it. He is under the control of trustees and governors, appointed guardians, appointed by his father, until he comes of age. And Paul says all the time he is the owner of it all, and yet he is controlled as though he was just a servant. Now, you couldn't say that about anybody who was adopted. If you take somebody else's illegitimate child and decide you're going to adopt him, is he already the owner of your property before you adopt him? Of course not. And Paul wasn't stupid enough to think he was. Only the churchmen are stupid enough for that. Now, what Paul was talking about was the coming of age ceremony, by which they marked the fact that the heir had now become of full age and his property was put into his hands to control as an adult. So, here in Romans 8, verse 16, the Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God, technon, one born a child, not adopted. Romans 9, verse 26. And he's quoting here from Hosea 1, verse 10. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, ye are not my people, there they shall be called the children of the living God. And again, it's that Greek word huioi, sons. We are the born, not adopted, children of God. Now, as to the born, not adopted or converted, children of the devil, take Acts verse 13, or chapter 13, verse 10. It tells about a Jew sorcerer, Elymas, who opposed Paul when Paul was trying to make some converts. Then Saul, who also is called Paul, filled with the Holy Ghost, set his eyes on him and said, O, full of all subtlety and all mischief, thou child of the devil, that Greek word huios, a son, thou son of the devil, thou enemy of all righteousness, wilt thou not to pervert the right ways of the Lord? Paul was under no illusions. He knew them to be children of the devil by perfectly legitimate ancestry, for what it's worth. Now, the child of a cat is another cat, isn't it? The child of a Negro is a Negro. And a child of God is what? Now, he's not as wise, and he's not as powerful, and he's not as important as his father. But nevertheless, he partakes within his limitations of the godly nature. And that's what the Bible tells us about it, and that is exactly why we of God's people Israel are held to so much greater responsibility than the other people. After all, you can't expect a Negro to act like anything but a Negro, but a child of God is expected to act like one. Now, the child of a devil is what? Another devil, isn't he? Now, John 6, verses 70 to 71. It's part of a very important passage. It begins, Jesus asks his disciples, who were all gathered together there, he said, whom do men say that I am? And they said, oh, some say that you're this prophet or that one who's been reincarnated and come back here. He said, whom do you say that I am? And Peter spoke up and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. So he said, blessed art thou, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood didn't tell you that fact. It was my Father in heaven who told you that. And he said, upon this rock, Petra, the solid bedrock of the earth, I will found my church. Now, he didn't say he was going to found it upon Peter, Simon Peter, Petros, a little stone. In Greek, Petros means a little stone just barely bigger than a pebble. Was he going to found his church on a pebble that anybody could kick out from under it? No. I will found it upon Petra, the solid bedrock of the earth. You remember the example that he gave, the parable? He said one man had built his house on the sand, and the storm came along, and the flood washed the sand out from under it, and it collapsed. But another man built his house upon the rock, Petra, the bedrock. And the storm beat upon it, and it couldn't do anything to it because it was founded on a rock, Petra. If any of you have ever been up the Yosemite Valley and seen that enormous cliff, El Capitan, you've seen a good example of what the Greeks meant by the word Petra. You could build a castle on that, and nothing could blow it off or wash it off. So, upon this fact that you have recognized who I am, the Christ, the Son of the living God, upon that I will found my church, and the gates of death shall not prevail against it. Then he goes on, John 6, verses 70 and 71. Jesus answered them, "Have not I chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil?" He spoke of Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon, for he it was that should betray him, being one of the 12. Now, our Savior was not just being vulgarly abusive and calling people names. He never did that. Oh, he denounced these Pharisees. Sure. He called them hypocrites, and they were. He wasn't abusing them with lying epithets. They were hypocrites, so he was accurate. And when he called them the children of serpents, well, they had said they were. That was the emblem they used all the way through. And when he said that one of them was a devil, he wasn't being abusive. He was speaking the literal truth. Now, the first epistle of John again states the existence of these two seed lines. 1 John 2, verse 29, "If ye know that he is righteous, ye know that everyone that does righteousness is born of him." 1 John 3, verse 2, "Beloved, now are we the sons of God," and that Greek word technon, a born child, not adopted, a born child of God. 1 John 3, verses 9 and 10, "Whosoever is born of God doth not commit sin, for his seed remaineth in him, and he cannot sin because he is born of God." Now, by that, he didn't mean that none of us commit any sins at all, because if that were the case, we wouldn't have needed the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross. We do all have our sins, but you've noticed that people are divided into two classes. The one who are only sorry because they don't get a chance to sin more, and the others who are sorry because they have sinned a little. So what he means there is, whoever is born of God doesn't habitually sin. So he says, "In this the children," that Greek word technon, "the children of God are manifest, and the children," and again it's that same Greek word technon, "of the devil." Remember, he's talked about us as the born technon of God, and the born technon of the devil. Now, 1 John 3, verse 12. He said that as to those who are our brothers, not the children of Satan, that we should love them and not be as Cain. Your King James Version says, "who was of that wicked one and slew his brother." So the people who have churchianity rather than Christianity say, "oh, well, now you know it doesn't say the son of, so it just means that Cain was morally associated with Satan and bad and reprobate and so on." Well, now, I believe my friend back in Minnesota will concede that there was just one Greek language at that time, and that they didn't have two separate Greek languages, one to write the Gospel according to Luke and a different Greek language in which to write the first epistle of John. As you know, different languages have their different idioms. In many languages, one word may have a meaning that can only be expressed by a phrase of several English words. I think nearly all of you have a King James Version of the Bible, and you know that in most editions of it, some words are printed in italics. And those words in italics are the words which the translators added because they thought it was necessary to give the English the same meaning that the Hebrew or the Greek had without these added words. Now, The third chapter of Luke traces the genealogy of Jesus Christ, starting with Jesus Christ and running backward all the way to Adam. So let's start with the 23rd verse of Luke chapter 3, as it reads in the King James Version. And Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, which was the son of Heli. But those words, the son, are in italics, showing that they were not in the Greek and the translators added them. Which was the son of Matthat, again added in italics, which was the son of Levi, in italics, which was the son of Melchi, italics, which was the son of Janna, and so forth, always in italics. Now, let's read this the way my friend would read 1 John 3, verse 12. The son of Joseph, who was as big a reprobate as Heli, who was morally no better than Matthat, who was as bad as Levi, is that the way he thinks Luke wrote this? And if that is not the meaning of the Greek here in Luke, it's not the meaning of the same Greek phrase over in 1 John 3, verse 12. So where it says, not as Cain, who was of that wicked one, in Greek it means who was the son of that wicked one. In Greek, if you say John was of William, you have said John was the son of William. Now, the better modern translations recognize this. For example, Weymouth. The same verse, 1 John 3, verse 12. We are not to resemble Cain, who was a child of the evil one and killed his brother. Philip's translation. We are none of us to have the spirit of Cain, who was a son of the devil and murdered his brother. The New English Bible, a magnificent job of translation, by the way. Unlike Cain, who was a child of the evil one and murdered his brother. Now, the thing which this gentleman cites in his magazine as the final proof positive that there isn't anything at all to this Jews are the children of Cain and hence of the devil theory, he cites the 8th chapter of John, beginning verse 31. You know how often I've cited that, do you? Only, he shows his ignorance. You remember, Jesus Christ was talking to Jews, and it says Jews, too, comes right out with the word. And it isn't simply that he was behaving like a petulant, spoiled child because somebody didn't believe in him, because it says these were Jews who believed in him. Yeah, converted Jews. You know all these missions to the Jews? These were converted Jews. And he says to them, and you can just hear the ring of sarcasm in his voice, if ye continue in my doctrines indeed, then ye shall be my disciples, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And immediately they bristle up at this. What do you mean, make us free? They say, we are Abraham's seed, and we have never been in bondage to any man. And he says, I know you're Abraham's seed. Now, to anyone who knew his Bible, and in the minister, it is utterly inexcusable that he does not know it. Because remember, this is the blind leading the blind into the ditch when an ignorant minister is leading his congregation. Who was it who could say that he was descended from Abraham and had never been in bondage to any man? If these Jews were of any of the 12 tribes at all, they'd been in bondage the first time in Egypt, hadn't they? If they belonged to the 10-tribe northerly kingdom of Israel, they'd been in bondage a second time in Assyria, hadn't they? And if they belonged to the two-tribed southern kingdom of Judah, they'd been in bondage the second time in Babylon, hadn't they? And these said, we have never been in bondage to any man. And Jesus Christ admitted the truth of it. He didn't deny that. So, they were not of any tribe of Israel whatsoever. Now, who could say that nevertheless, 1,800 years earlier than that, Abraham was one of his ancestors? Esau. Remember, Esau and Jacob were twins, born with the same bloodline. But Esau married two Canaanite women, you remember, in violation of God's law. Now, he couldn't leave anything but mongrelized, half-satanic descendants, because among these Hittite Canaanites, you had the satanic bloodline. What the Bible tells you about Esau selling his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of lentil stew, that isn't when he lost it. That was merely a formal ceremony by which he gave up any claim to it. But he lost it when he did the thing that rendered it impossible for him to continue as the head of the clan. His descendants from now on would be mongrelized, half-satanic. So, recognizing that, he was already out of the line for the leadership. He sold it for a bowl of stew. Now, the Bible tells you that Esau and his two Canaanite wives moved down to Mount Seir, a very rugged mountain range southeast of the Dead Sea. But Mount Seir is exactly where some of these people who were descendants of these fallen angels. Go back to Genesis chapter 6. And among the people who had the bloodline of the fallen angels were these Horites, the Horim, the cave dwellers, who lived in Mount Seir. Now suppose a white man married two Negresses here, and then he moved to the interior of the Congo, and for the next 18 centuries his descendants lived there with nobody they could marry except the Negroes around them. The last trace of white blood would have vanished. Nevertheless, after 18 centuries of breeding into the Negroes, they could still say, 18 centuries ago, we had one white ancestor. Now, these weren't Negroes. These were the satanic Canaanites. But the principle is the same. These Jews talking with Jesus Christ had identified themselves as Edomite Jews. Genesis chapter 36 lists Esau's descendants. Verses 20 to 30 especially list the various dukes or chieftains among the family of Seir, the Horite, satanic line, including his daughter Timnah. And Genesis 36 verse 12 shows that Timnah was a concubine to Esau's son Eliphaz and bore him a son Amalek. And you remember what a pestilential lot the whole tribe of Amalek were. They behaved throughout according to the satanic bloodline. You'll find a good deal of that in Exodus chapter 17, verses 8 to 16, and Numbers 20, verses 14 to 21. Now, this same satanic conduct on the part of the Edomites was repeated as opportunity arose. You remember that when the people of Israel came out of Egypt in the Exodus and they wanted to march on up to Palestine, they were attacked by the Edomites and driven back. So they had to detour around down through the wilderness in the Sinai Peninsula. Again, when the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar captured Jerusalem and looted and burned the city and massacred a lot of the inhabitants, the Edomites came rushing in to help in the massacre and plunder. The whole book of Obadiah is just one continuous condemnation of the Edomites for the way they acted and predicting their eventual slaughter and punishment for it. Obadiah verse 10, "For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever." Obadiah verse 15, "For the day of Yahweh is near upon all the heathen. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head." Obadiah verse 18, "And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble, and they shall kindle in them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Yahweh hath spoken it." Amen, say I. Exodus 17, verses 14 to 16. "And Yahweh said unto Moses, Write this for a memorial in the book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua. For I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Yahweh Nissi, Yahweh our banner. For he said, Because Yahweh hath sworn that Yahweh will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." Now, how did these satanic, mongrel, Edomite Jews get up there into Judea? They came in two principal waves. During the time that the southern kingdom of Judah was practically empty during the Babylonian captivity, the Edomites were driven out of Mount Seir by a heavy invasion of an Arab people, the Nabataeans, from the east. So the Edomites were driven westwardly. Now, they couldn't go southwest or straight west. They'd be getting into Egyptian territory, and they weren't strong enough to fight the Egyptians. So they went slightly north of west, and they took over the southerly half of what had been the kingdom of Judah and settled there. Now, when the little remnant came back from Babylon, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah show that 42,000, 600 or something like that, came back. But it lists them by their families, and you run those down, and you find that slightly over 8,000 of these were not from any tribe of Israel. In other words, only 34,000 of the 42,000 who came back were Israelites of the tribes of Judah, Benjamin, and a few Levites among them. Now, they were too few to drive out these numerous and warlike Edomites. All they could do was settle in the little territory left them. To give you an idea of the size of that, the entire territory of the 12-tribe nation of Israel before it broke up, set down here in Southern California, would extend from the Mexican border to the southerly part of the city of Los Angeles. Inland from the coast, it never was more than 40 miles wide. Now divide that into thirds. The northerly two-thirds of that comprised the kingdom of Israel, the 10-tribe northern kingdom. So only the southerly one-third of that was the kingdom of Judah. Now, of that one-third, take out the southerly half of that, now occupied by the Edomites, and the little strip left is all that remains for the true Judahites and Benjamites to settle in. Before the captivity, the tribe of Judah had been on the south, the tribe of Benjamin on the north, with the city of Jerusalem lying right on the boundary line between them. Well, they sorted themselves out as well as they could, the way they had been before. Judah on the south, and Benjamin pushed to the north. But Benjamin couldn't just back up to the north a little bit, because north of them was the center. Remember, I said you'd divide this 12-tribe territory into thirds. The middle third constituted Samaria. And both Isaiah and Kings and Chronicles tell you that when the Assyrians captured the northern kingdom of Israel and deported all its people, they brought other people from Assyria and settled them in Samaria. Now, it purposely fails to say they settled anybody in Galilee, the northernmost portion. They didn't. They left it vacant. Now, the Benjamites, pushed to the north by the Judahites as they returned after the captivity, they couldn't just back up into Samaria. That was fully settled. So they had to leapfrog over Samaria into the vacant Galilee to the north of that. Now, you remember, up in Galilee was Christ's own hometown of Bethlehem, Nazareth, I should say. His family home was up in Nazareth. And you remember he got nearly all of his converts up in Galilee. And of the 12 disciples, only Judas was a Jew. Your Bible calls him Judas Iscariot, and there's no such word as Iscariot in any language known to man. It's a corruption of the Hebrew words Ish-Kerioth, man of Kerioth. And Kerioth is a little village down in the southwesterly portion of Judea, down in the territory occupied by the Edomites. So Judas was an Edomite Jew, and he was the only Jew of the 12. The other 11 were all Galileans, therefore Benjamites.
You have been listening to a message by the late Pastor Burtondale Compre from his sermon titled The Cain Satanic Seed Line. If you would like a complete tape or MP3 CD of this talk, ask for it by name with the number 123 and send a donation to cover our costs and help with radio time. This sermon, The Cain Satanic Seed Line, is also available in booklet form for an additional donation of $2. Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.